Let me welcome you to the 14th lesson in this verse-by-verse series through the book of Zechariah, brought to you by Mission 119 Ministries. This is, in fact, the second to the last lesson in the series, and I hope if you've not gone back and listened to some of the earlier ones that you will do that. The series is entitled Looking Forward, Living Now. More detailed notes are available in the book Looking Forward, Living Now, available on Amazon. Our text today is Zechariah chapter 13. Remember, the book has 14 chapters total, so the next lesson will cover the final chapter. The title of this lesson is Take Away Sins. Now, the writer to Hebrews explains that the law of Moses is a shadow of good things to come and not the very image of those things. The reason the law is a shadow or a sketch of good things to come is that the Jewish people could never, with those sacrifices which they offered year by year, continually make the comers thereunto perfect, Hebrews 10 and verse 1. That harsh reality is evident because in those sacrifices there is a remembrance, again, made of sins every year, Hebrews 10 verse 3. The sacrifices were annually repeated because it's not possible that the blood of bulls and goats should take away sins, Hebrews 10 4. Note that the last three words, take away sins, that's the greatest need the Jewish people have, and of course the Gentiles as well. And the law provides no solution for it. We can understand the significance in John, the baptizer's words, when he seeth Jesus coming unto him and saith, Behold, the Lamb of God, which taketh away the sin of the world. Turning back to the book of Hebrews, the writer says of Jesus Christ, Wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, Sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body hast thou prepared me, Hebrews 10:5. While the offerings of the priest in the Old Testament can never take away sins, by one offering Jesus hath perfected forever them that are sanctified, Hebrews 10, verse 14. At the cross, Jesus opened a fountain that washes sins away. And Zechariah speaks to that fountain in the text before us today, Zechariah chapter 13. Now, this chapter continues the explanation of the spiritual deliverance of Israel that occurs in the day of the Lord. In Zechariah chapter 12, verse 10, the prophet writes that God will pour upon Israel the spirit of grace and of supplications, with the result that they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him. There will be a time of national revival where the Jewish people realize they murdered the Messiah at his first advent, and under great conviction, there will be a time of deep mourning. The lamentation of repentance that results when Judah sees the one whom they have pierced by their apostate disobedience will in turn result in their forgiveness, an act described in the present unit as a purification or a cleansing. This great conviction results in changing their thinking about who Jesus is. No longer will they view him as a blasphemer worthy of death, but they will recognize him as the Messiah, and in their hearts they will say, and I draw these words from Matthew 23, verse 39, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. At that time, there will be a true national day of atonement, and their sins will be washed away forever. Now, with this background, we'll move into the first verse of Zechariah 13. Do keep in mind that chapters 12, 13, and 14 form a single unit called a burden, and it is the final unit of thought in the whole book, and we're smack dab in the middle of it here in chapter 13. In that day there shall be a fountain opened to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. The verse begins with the phrase in that day, a phrase repeatedly used in chapter 12. This is one of those instances where a chapter break is awkwardly placed, splitting an otherwise cohesive unit of thought. As before, in that day is shorthand for the day of the Lord, and it refers to the future time when Messiah returns, bringing judgment to Israel's enemies and blessing to Israel. The phrase in that day occurs 20 times in the book of Zechariah. The verse that we're looking at is a continuation of the future national revival experienced by Israel as introduced in Zechariah chapter 12, verses 10 to 14. The text says, A fountain is opened and its waters washed sin away. This idea is pictured elsewhere in the Old Testament. For example, in Ezekiel 36:25, Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and you shall be clean from all your filthiness, and from all your idols will I cleanse you. Other passages use the idea of water as cleansing and life-giving, such as Numbers 31:23 and Isaiah 12:2 and 3. Jesus offers living waters to the woman at the well in John 4. To be saved, a person must be cleansed of their sin. The prophet Zechariah says that there shall be a fountain open to the house of David and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness. He pinpoints the recipients of this blessing as both the house of David, which refers to the leadership of the nation, as well as the inhabitants of Jerusalem. That's the general populace. This is similar to what he did in chapter 12, verse 10, in relation to the pouring out of the Spirit of grace and supplications. Some people see in chapter 13, verse 1, a reference to the cross or the so-called gospel age. But while it is true that the fountain was actually opened in the first century at Calvary for all people, Zechariah's present oracle points to an occurrence that he places in that day, a specific time marker, repeated again in verses 2 and 4. He looks to a specific final work of God regarding his people Israel. The fountain is an artesian well, continuously spewing forth living waters that will remove both sin and uncleanness. While sin concerns a failure to conform to God's will, which for the Jewish people in Zechariah's day was set forth in, you know, the Mosaic Law and much of what we would call our Old Testament, uncleanness is a state of defilement or impurity that occurs when a person breaches God's principles of holiness. Now, as expositor Duane Lindsay says, and I quote, on the day of Christ's crucifixion, the fountain was opened potentially for all Israel and the whole world. At the second advent of Christ, the fountain will be opened experientially for the Jewish nation. End of quote. This future event is associated with the fulfillment of the new covenant with Israel, a concept frequently referred to in the prophets. Some references there are Jeremiah 31, verses 33 and 34, and Ezekiel 36, verse 25. As the writer of the book of Hebrews affirms, Jesus is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises, Hebrews 8, verse 6. He's also the mediator of a New Testament, Hebrews 9, verse 15. I'd encourage you to read all of Hebrews 9. You can also get a Mission 119 commentary from Amazon on the book of Hebrews that goes into some detail on that that material in Hebrews. Now, moving on, because there is fault with the covenant God made with Israel through Moses, and that it could not cleanse people of sin, God promised to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. That's Hebrews 8, verses 7 to 8. This new covenant will not be like the original one God made with Moses. In fact, the new covenant is inaugurated in Jesus' blood. You are no doubt familiar with Matthew 26, verse 28, where Jesus says, "This is the blood," or "This is my blood of the New Testament," or the new covenant, "which is shed for many for the remission of sins." But the fulfillment of the promises of the new covenant to Israel has not yet occurred. The Apostle Paul specifically associates that fulfillment with the second advent of Messiah, just like Zechariah does in the current passage. And you can read about that in Romans 11, 25 through 27. At that future time, the fountain provided at Calvary will be opened to Israel experientially, and the result will be a great national revival. With the righteousness of God written in their hearts, the nation will be cleansed of sins. And moving to verse 2, "It shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord of hosts, that I will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and they shall no more be remembered. And I also will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land." Again, emphasizing the time period being in that day, Zechariah writes that it shall come to pass. Despite God's assurance that it shall happen, I note here that most expositors teach the opposite. That is, these blessings are spiritualized away as church blessings so that the plain sense of the verses, as they would have been understood by Zechariah and his audience, the Jewish people, for centuries after that, will never come to pass. But any notion that Israel forfeited these blessings is misguided, because the book of Zechariah foresees both Israel's future failures and God's return of blessing to them after those failures. The question of whether these things shall come to pass doesn't depend on Israel, but on the veracity of God himself. Now, the Lord of hosts says, and this is right from the text, he will cut off the names of the idols out of the land, and there should be no more remembered. Now, I noted above, or previously, that this passage captures the fulfillment of New Covenant blessings to Israel. It's not just that a future generation will experience a revival, but they will have God's law in their inward parts, according to Jeremiah 31:33. For God will write it in their hearts and will be their God, and they shall be my people, the text there says in Jeremiah 31. As a result, the nation will be characteristically righteous in a way that never happened before. The Lord of hosts will remove sin from the land and from the daily experience of the people. This is no doubt what the prophet sees symbolically in his vision in chapter 5, verses 5 to 11, where wickedness is personified as a female who's placed in a bucket or an ephah and flown back to Shinar or Babylon, thus cleansing the land. The sin here is typified by two of its most serious manifestations. Throughout the Old Testament, you find two recurring sins among Israel, idolatry and false prophecy, false teachers. These serious issues are addressed in many other places like Jeremiah 23, Ezekiel 13, Lamentations chapter 2. That God will cut off or remove the names of the idols means that idolatry will with finality be removed and forgotten. Israel's history reveals its persistent engagement in idolatry up until the time of the exile. Now, some argue that in post-exilic Israel, idolatry is gone, from which they conjecture that Zechariah wrote the subject passage prior to the exile into Babylonian captivity. But even if there was a historical respite within Israel from this sin of idolatry, that does not mean that Israel will not engage in idolatry again in the future. Further, we know from Jesus' preaching in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 that false prophets will remain until his return. You can see that in Matthew 24, verses 4 to 5, verse 11, verses 23 to 24. In the book of Revelation, at the end of our Bibles, during the tribulation period, the false prophet leads and deceives the world into worshiping the beast, who is the Antichrist, and an animated idol, an animated image of him. Thus, it is entirely fitting that in that day, God will cause the prophets and the unclean spirit to pass out of the land of Israel. Concerning the reference to the unclean spirit, we note that demonic activity has always been around. We see it especially in the Gospels, where Jesus and his disciples cast out demons. We also see unclean spirits at work during the tribulation period, for example, in Revelation 16, verses 13 to 14, and Revelation 18, verse 2. But as the kingdom is implemented, Satan's demons are bound for 1,000 years, according to Revelation 20. What is recorded in the book of Revelation is the fulfillment of God's promise here in Zechariah to remove the unclean spirit from the land. Moving to verse 3, it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begat him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. And his father and his mother that begat him shall thrust him through when he prophesieth. Now, emphasizing the spiritual change that will occur and result in a removal of false prophets, God says, just reading from the text again, it shall come to pass that when any shall yet prophesy, then his father and his mother that begot him shall say unto him, Thou shalt not live. You know, the law required the execution of false prophets. You see that in Deuteronomy 13. False prophets frequently led the people into idolatry, and for such a grave crime, the death penalty was imposed. Even if it involved family, and you can read about that in Deuteronomy 13, verses 6 to 10. It speaks of a brother or a son that's engaged in this terrible sin. Consistent with this, the spiritual environment of Israel after the pouring out of the spirit of grace and supplications that we saw referenced in Zechariah 12, verse 10, as well as the opening of a fountain to the inhabitants of Jerusalem for sin and for uncleanness that we've seen in this chapter, these will be such that the false prophet's own parents will insist on his execution for his sin. They will make the charge, for thou speakest lies in the name of the Lord. So instead of mom or dad covering for a child, they'll be the first ones to stand forward and lodge the accusation. The false prophet says, God said, when in fact God never said. And as a result, his father and mother that begat him shall thrust him through because he falsely prophesies. They will in that day revere their relationship with God more than all other human relationships. Some may protest that this is too severe to be accepted at face value, or that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. But we must remember that false prophets proliferate deception. They cause nothing but despair and death, pushing those under their influence away from God with eternal consequences. And again, the people of God at this time experience the blessings of the new covenant, and they have the very righteousness of God written in their hearts in a way that never happens until this time. Their attitude towards sin now reflects God's attitude towards sin, which is vastly different than how most people today, Christians included, perceive sin. Moving to verse 4, "It shall come to pass in that day that the prophets shall be ashamed every one of his vision when he hath prophesied, neither shall they wear a rough garment to deceive." I have to say there's a tremendous difference between regret and remorse. We routinely hear apologies from public figures caught in some criminal or immoral activity, usually after they've denied wrongdoing, and then the indisputable evidence of their guilt in some sort of video or secret recording surfaces. Of course, they regret what they did because they were caught, but that's not the same as remorse. In the same way, we read here, "It shall come to pass in that day that the false prophets will get outed." The text says they'll be ashamed, every one of his false vision, when he hath prophesied. But I think this is the opposite of what they did previously, spreading their venom with impunity. When it says the prophet shall be ashamed of their false teaching, it's because of the severity of the punishment. And so they try to hide their crime. That's what it means to be ashamed of it. They hide it. To evade the penalty of execution, they will remove their rough garment that they wore, which was the traditional garment to be worn by a prophet. It was part of their costume to help them deceive the people. You see John the Baptist wear that kind of garment in the New Testament. Of course, he was not deceiving anybody, but it marked him as a prophet of God. And so they would wear the attire, the clothing of a prophet. It was all part of the deception. Verse 5, "But he shall say, I am no prophet. I am a husbandman, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth." You know, when the false prophet's interrogated, he's not going to fall on his sword and admit his crime. He's going to deny it. He's going to say, I'm not a prophet. Denying his guilt, he will claim some other trade, such as being a farmer, the King James calls a husbandman, or a rancher. He says, for man taught me to keep cattle from my youth. So maybe he says, I'm a rancher, I'm a farmer. Zechariah's words are actually quoting and paraphrasing the prophet Amos's testimony when he gave his own background in Amos chapter 7, verse 14. Amos said, I'm not a prophet's son. I was a herdman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit. But in contrast to Amos, who used his background to give validity to his calling, the false prophets will lie about their background to evade the charge of being false prophets. They will claim it from my youth. That is, they'll say they've always had the same trade. They've never worked as a false prophet. Verse 6, "One shall say unto him, what are these wounds in thy hands? Then he shall answer, those with which I was wounded in the house of my friends." The problem the prophets have is there is evidence to the contrary. There is evidence that they are in fact prophets. The false prophet's testimony that they're really farmers and ranchers will not be believed because of visible evidence that gives them away, and in particular, self-inflicted wounds. You can read about that in 1 Kings 18:28. Those visible self-inflicted wounds will give them away. They're indicative of self-mutilation commonly practiced by idolatrous prophets and priests, but strictly forbidden among God's true prophets, according to Deuteronomy 14:1. These wounds provide the irrefutable evidence that they are in fact, or at least previously engaged, as false prophets. But when they're asked about it, when they're asked, what are these wounds in your hands, they're going to lie about it, and they're going to say, and we just have in the text here a representative of the sort of the absurdity of their lies, they'll say, well, these are those which I was wounded in the house of my friends. In other words, they're just the result of an accident that happened. They didn't come from self-mutilation. But their lies are to no avail, as 13 verse 2 that we've already covered confirms. Verse 7, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts. Smite the shepherd, and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones." Zechariah now presents a new oracle that returns to the shepherd motif seen in chapter 9, verse 16, and chapter 10, verses 2 to 3, and in chapter 11, verses 4 to 17. Recall that in chapter 11, the Messiah is the good shepherd who was rejected, and his services were valued at 30 pieces of silver, the price of a slave. While we know from the New Testament that this looked forward to the crucifixion, Zechariah now makes the death of the good shepherd very explicit. Here, my shepherd, meaning God's shepherd, is not only rejected, but he's killed. It's shown forth below. This is undisputably about the crucifixion of Jesus, but one may question the abrupt change in focus from the future day of the Lord that was in chapter 12, verse 1, all the way through 13, verse 6 that we just covered. All of that was associated with the second advent of Jesus and the cleansing of the land of idolatry and all that stuff, and now we're switching back to the first advent. Zechariah goes back to the shepherd theme to elaborate on Israel's condition, their need for God's intervention, and how the fountain of chapter 13, verse 1 is made possible. I also note that the general structure of chapter 13 mirrors chapter 9. Both chapters focus on events in the day of the Lord, with one verse dividing the material with a focal point on the first advent. Right in the middle of Zechariah 9, you have verse 9, that points to what we usually call the triumphal entry, which happens during Jesus' earthly ministry. And here in Zechariah 13, right in the middle, the seventh verse is a focal verse, again, pointing to the first advent, but now to the death of Christ during his earthly ministry. Listen to God's words very carefully. God says to the prophet, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, and against the man that is my fellow, saith the Lord of hosts." The use of the word sword does not mean, of course, a literal sword, but merely a violent death. We know that happened by crucifixion. God's shepherd is the man that is my fellow. That word, the man, indicates his humanity, while my fellow indicates a peer or an equal to God, yet another Old Testament statement to the deity of Christ. The God, that God awakens the sword indicates that it is in fact God's will that the shepherd die, consistent with his command to smite or strike the shepherd. When we read the Gospels, we realize both that Jesus cannot be taken to that rugged cross except that he permits it. For example, Matthew 26, verse 53. We also realize it's the Father's will that Jesus permit himself to be placed on the tree, Matthew 16, verse 21. From a human perspective, the Jewish leadership and the Roman officials think that they are determining Jesus' fate, but it was always the Father's will that Jesus, the priest king, would offer himself on a Roman cross as the once-for-all-time sacrifice for sin. Now, as a result of the death of the shepherd, it says in this text in Zechariah, the sheep shall be scattered, and God will turn his hand upon the little or the insignificant ones in the flock. Jesus applies this passage to himself, in fact, as you read Matthew 26, verse 31. Jesus said unto them, "All ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it's written, I will smite the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered abroad." Israel shall be scattered as a result of its rejection of Jesus, but the phrase, "I will turn my hand upon the little ones," could be misunderstood. The little ones refer, no doubt, to the poor of the flock that we read about in chapter 11, verse 11, those that, quote, "wait upon me and knew that it was the word of the Lord." The idea of God turning his hand upon someone can refer to judgment, but it can also refer to salvation or deliverance. That God will bless a believing remnant is further confirmed in what follows, and that's the idea here of turning his hand upon the little ones. While Jewish nation as a whole will murder Messiah in the first advent, there will be those who are not guilty of that, and they've trusted him as Messiah, and God is going to bless them. So, verse 8, "It shall come to pass that in all the land, saith the Lord, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third part shall be left therein." Whereas verse 7 concerns the first advent, the first coming of Christ, and specifically his crucifixion, verse 8 looks forward again to, quote, "that day," just before the Lord's return. We see this in Zechariah 9, verses 9 to 10, where verse 9 was about the triumphal entry, but verse 10 awaits the return of the king. There's no explicit statement in 13:7 or 13:8 that there will be a gap of time between the two verses, but in light of New Testament revelation, we know that that's the case. The Lord says, "It shall come to pass that in the land of Israel two parts therein shall be cut off and die, but the third shall be left therein." This speaks to a refined remnant of Israel. It is reminiscent of Ezekiel 5, verses 1 to 12, where God commands the prophet Ezekiel to shave his head and divide the hair into three equal portions, and he burns or destroys two of those portions of his hair, throwing the rest into the wind so it will be scattered thereby killing two-thirds of the house of Israel as a judgment for their refusal to obey God's statutes and keep his judgments. Now, while Ezekiel may only have been looking forward to Nebuchadnezzar's victory over Jerusalem, the parallel is obvious. With Ezekiel's prophecy, even the one-third that were not destroyed were still relegated to the trial of being scattered abroad. And ultimately, they were refined, and a refined remnant returned to the land. In the next verse, we see that God's purpose in the refining of his people is spelled out. Listen to verse 9, the last verse of this chapter. "And I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, the Lord is my God." You see, God will bring the third part through the fire. God's purpose in permitting them to experience the trials ahead is to refine them the way silver is refined and try them as gold is tried. You heat up the metal and you put it through the furnace, but the dross, the impurities, are boiled out of it and removed. This process plays a role in turning them to Jesus. For it to be a refined remnant of Jewish people that shall call on my name, God says, and I will hear them. You know, for all that to happen, there has to be a refined remnant. God's response to the remnant will be, it is my people, to which they will affirm, the Lord is my God. During the tribulation, the remnant will call on God's name in prayer, and he will physically deliver them. As we see in Zechariah 12, the Apostle Paul writes about this in Romans 10, verse 13, when he says, "For whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." I know that gets abused into certain gospel invitations and so forth, but that, of course, has nothing to do with the context when Paul in Romans 10:13 quotes from Joel 2, verse 32. This future deliverance will be in connection with the second coming of the King, Jesus. What follows in the final chapter of Zechariah that we'll cover in the next lesson will be all the details about this glorious deliverance, and it really is the climactic chapter, so you'll want to tune in once that last lesson is posted. Now, in closing, although God will deliver Israel from her enemies into the future day of the Lord, he will not deliver every Jewish person. Instead, he will preserve a refined remnant through various trials. Zechariah likens the refining process that produces this remnant to the refining of silver or gold to remove impurities. Note that the text does not say God keeps them out of the trials. In a similar way, God uses the trials of life to refine the faith of Christians today. Peter writes that we are begotten again of the Father for a lively or living hope, namely an inheritance that's incorruptible and undefiled, and that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for us. As Christians, there is a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time, 1 Peter 1:5, when we will receive that inheritance. But Peter's immediate audience in 1 Peter is enduring persecutions and trials. So he writes in 1 Peter 1:6, "Wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you're in heaviness through manifold trials." The purpose of the trial or the testing of your faith being more precious than gold that perisheth, though it be tried by fire, is that your faith be found under praise and honor and glory at the appearance of Jesus Christ, 1 Peter 1:7. The faith Peter writes of is not faith in the gospel message, where he assumes his audience is composed of believers. They are begotten again or born again children of God. Rather, it is believing God's word in general and living life on that basis that is the issue. Peter explains, "We should as newborn babes desire the sincere milk of the word, that we may grow thereby," 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 2. The trials of life refine our faith like refining gold or silver as we respond to those trials on the basis of God's word. This is how we experience spiritual growth. And by the way, there's no plan B. This refined grown-up faith, Peter says, is more valuable than earthly gold because this quality of faith appropriates our portion of our inheritance in the kingdom. When we stand before Jesus, our refined faith will result in our praise and honor and glory. He's going to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Well, main principle in chapter 13 of Zechariah: in the day of the Lord, the fountain for washing away sins made available by Jesus Christ when he died on a Roman cross now becomes experientially realized by a refined remnant of Jewish people, as they will experience revival and receive the new covenant blessing of having the righteousness of God written in their hearts. And a corollary, idolatry and false prophets will be permanently removed from the land of Israel during the tribulation period, during the day of the Lord. Hey, well, as I've said earlier, the next lesson will be the conclusion to this series as we cover the ultimate chapter and the climactic chapter of Zechariah. I hope you'll tune in. In the meantime, God bless you.